Hello there. Welcome to the Herbcast, the podcast from Herbal Reality, delving into the plant-powered world of herbalism. So do you know your echinacea from your Eleutherococcus, or your polyphenol from your polysaccharides? Whether you're a budding herbalist, an inquisitive health professional, or a botanical beginner, Herbcast is here to inform and inspire you on your journey to integrating herbs in our everyday lives. So settle down, turn us up, and let's start today's episode of the Herbal Reality Herbcast. I'm here with Graham Tobin today, and really good to see you, Graham.
Yeah, and you, Sebastian. Great to be here.
I'll just give you a quick introduction to our audience that you're... got a background as a herbalist. I think you've been practicing for over 30 odd years or something.
Well, Graham. No, 26 it was.
Oh, 26.
Yeah.
And but you've been working as an educator and author, and you're currently working at the University of Lancashire and in the herbal medicine course. Yeah. And integrated medicine degree.
That's right. I've been there 23 years. So
23 years. Oh, yeah. Great. Well, it's a real treat for us to have you with us.
Well, yeah, and, thanks for inviting me along.
And so in this series of a Herbcast, Graham, we're talking about herbal actions and really looking at the different categories. How useful are they? What benefits do they have for herbalists to be able to use herbs in that way? And today we've chosen the potentially controversial category of alternatives to look at.
Yeah, I like controversy. Yeah, but actually, I'm just going to blow my trumpet a bit right now, because we had a section on alterations under the monograph of Burdock in the Western herbal tradition. And David Hoffman, in his review of the Western herbal tradition, said that it was one of the best things he had read on alterations. So that chapter on Burdock was actually the one that I edited. You know, what Alison, Denham, Midge Whiteleg and I did was we did our historical research or our sources research. And then we singly edited different chapters. So Burdock was mine. So in that sense, you know, I'm very pleased to have been invited to speak about alternatives.
Just put this up, Graham. This is the book I was also looking at it this morning.
That's right. That's the first edition.
Book you're talking about. It's got a great entry from you on Burdock and a bit of a discussion about alternatives.
That's right. I mean, the other alternatives in the book are fumitory, goosegrass, figwort, and heartsease. So we're just naming some alternatives here, and I'll be naming other plant alternatives in a minute as well. And let's get our definition in early, shall we, Sebastian? So this is Albert and Lillian Priest from Herbal Medication. An alternative is a medicine that alters the process of nutrition, restoring in some unknown way the normal functions of an organ or of the system, re-establishing healthy nutritive processes. So that's a fundamental definition of alternative that we should take away. So that's referring, of course, to that sort of trophorestoration, which was, you know, part of that physiomedical treatment strategy. But they also talk about how alternatives are used to detoxify. You know? And we know that other words like depurative or blood cleanser are used. But just let me say something else about the Western herbal tradition as well, because obviously I'd already written the book on Culpeper, so I was already immersing myself in that sort of Hippocratic Galenic tradition. And so when Mills and Bones' Principles of Practice of Phytotherapy comes out, and they sort of say, traditionally use those. Look, I've got this quote about Burdock. Burdock, say Mills and Bone, is one of the plant remedies traditionally used as alternatives. Traditionally used as alternative. Now, you see, that irritated me slightly, because there is no category of alternative when you get back to Culpeper's time, or even before then, as I show in the monograph on Burdock. So you know, that
was... When was it first used, Graham, then? When was it first used?
It's first used in, I think, the early 19th century.
Because it's in King's American Dispensator, isn't it? And all those texts on...
That's right. And, that's right.
And yarrow and herbs like that I mentioned there. Yeah.
So, you see, I felt that, you know, that comment was not really looking at the whole tradition to say traditionally used as. And that was one spur for writing the Western herbal tradition, to sort of correct that misapprehension about the tradition. Of course, in Principles and Practice of Phytotherapy, the two alterations that they include in their Small Materia Medica are echinacea and phytolacca. So those are two other alterations as recognized by priest and priest, for instance. But of course, echinacea is then called an immunostimulant by 2000. And an anti-inflammatory. And phytolacca is predominantly an anti-inflammatory, but also a lymphatic and depurative. So although they're avoiding the category alterative in Principles and Practice Phytotherapy, they still want to describe phytolacca as depurative. So what I'm getting at here is that there's a whole play on words which needs kind of deconstructing. But quite rightly, Mills and Bone show that such herbs are indicated in chronic conditions. Chronic tonsillitis and chronic sore throat are the presentations where they advise on those herbs. Okay, fair enough. Now, another source. I don't know about you, Sebastian, Rudolf Weiss's Herbal Medicine. The first edition, of course, because the second edition, which I remember Heinz Elstra was really pleased to have this, you know, phytotherapy colleague from the continent, you know, producing this textbook that he was massively recommending. And it is a great book. The second edition, unfortunately, they tried to make it very scientific by building in all this research evidence, and it sort of diluted the wealth of experience you get from reading Weiss's clear opinions on herbs that is evident in the first edition. And he says the old notion of cleansing the blood is obsolete. We see it as a somewhat milder form of antidiscratic therapy that is not used when disease has definitely developed, but early on, when the subject experiences a general feeling of tiredness or weakness. It is more or less understood under the term prophylaxis or prevention, i.e. springtime cures, watercress, dandelion, parsley and nettle. And he loves his alder buckthorn, which we might go, ooh, stimulant, laxative, anthraquinone, glycoside, you know, but he sees that as actually a rather mild herb that doesn't require correction with carminatives, although he does like his blackthorn, Prunus spinosa, and other reducing teas with senna, which I'll come to in a minute, because they, you know, they're definitely our stimulant laxatives. Mm-hmm. So you're happy with that differentiation, aren't you, between alterative and laxative?
I mean, I'm personally comfortable with the term alterative, but I'm interested that we seem to have potentially some sort of herbalist complex. There's some sort of embarrassment going on potentially about it, as you see being justified in the last two bits of literature you refer to, in a sense of slightly, because it got mixed up in blood cleansing and some of this language that could appear to be unobservable or immeasurable on some level. It became a sort of split in the language, because I've got a big background in Ayurvedic and Chinese medicine and Rakta Shodhana, or cleansing the blood or clearing heat toxins from the blood in Chinese medicine, the ABC of practice. I'm comfortable with the language, but I'm fascinated in this discussion within particularly Western context,
yeah,
of how we evolve that language and how we come to understand how herbs work. But in clinical practice, it seems that alterations are alive and well, and that is how they are applied by lots of herbalists in that sort of early stages of treatment. In a less, I know you just touched on senna and buckthorn and things like that. You know, we're much more gentle, it feels like, in this sort of early stages approach.
Yes, that's a really good point, because I want to take that up. You see, I believe that there's a retreat going on, a retreat from the use of stimulant laxatives. But I've still got some unfolding to do. So that was Weiss, who is a phytotherapist, a consultant doctor specializing in herbal medicine on the continent. If we turn to Priest and Priest, you know, which was published in 1982, their text Herbal Medication, which, you know, I think NIM now sell copies of that. Mm-hmm. They talk about the alteratives influencing the qualitative state of the blood supply, cleansing the blood of impurities by affecting mechanisms of intermediate metabolism, thus nutrition and toxicity. And that's not far away from your Eastern categories, you know, why not? For Priest and Priest, there are three types of alteratives. There's the relaxing ones, the stimulating ones, and the toning ones. And they act slowly, but we must imagine that the stimulating ones are going to be a bit more perky than that. So they say in chronic conditions, more stimulating ones are required, but at what speed? What is the dose for that? Alterative reaction will necessarily be slow, and they say 2 to 3 years to secure a fundamental tissue change. Now, I can't imagine giving alteratives to a patient for 2 to 3 years, expecting them to come back each time as a minuscule adjustment is made to their condition. It's the kind of thing that might work if, you know, the patient is a lot better, but there's still a, you know, you still think that there's improvement to be made. And so you're doing repeat prescriptions, mm-hmm. over, you know, a good year or so using an alterative. So when you look at the Eastern category, Sebastian, I mean, what's the time period for using those ones that clear, you know, heat toxicity in the blood? Or
I mean, at the stronger end of things, you'd just be using for a few days or such, yeah. Like that. You would not be using it for long periods of time. But for general, should we say, you know, I don't know, skin inflammation or something like that, you know, you're going to want to see results pretty quickly, because A, people are suffering, and B, it's expensive or costs money and time. And C, you want to make sure you're using the right formula, because you don't want to go on for too long just hoping that over time the tissues will
that's
be cleansed.
Right.
So
that's
a
mistake that inexperienced herbalists or students will make, you know, let's just keep on with that. And, you know, that's sort of a
balance, isn't it? Depends what's being poured in the top of the vase. Depends what the client is, what factors are causing their system to become purified, should we say, for that language, or imbalanced. So, but you basically want to see results pretty quickly with these areas that I would call toxic, you know, or where you've got armor or congestion, bloating, sluggishness, etc. You want to see quick results, so not too long. And I'm more of a higher dose end of things to get things going, I'd say.
Yeah,
just because I think the descriptions in the literature you're reading, I think we're more robust to slightly stronger treatments, perhaps. That would be the nature of the day. From a natural medicine point of view, and you know, pain and things like that were much more prevalent in a way. We weren't so accustomed to painkillers and things. So it's obviously this topic has risen again and again in history, where there are these systems and, you know, these pathologies in people that aren't getting removed by natural healing processes and need some stronger intervention. And I like this sort of catalytic effect that you get from the range.
So that sort of 2 to 3 years of, you know, but at least the Priest and Priest qualify that. They say eliminative action and functional regulation requires a near physiological dose, whatever that is, over a relatively short period. So that's what we're talking about there. But alterative action and tropho restoration requires a possibly very small dose on a long-term basis. So they want to make those two distinctions between elimination of toxins and tropho restoration. Mm. So their alteratives in their tables near the back of the book, they have burdock as a general alterative that's also a diuretic. And then most of the other alteratives are stimulating. Bladderwrack, Blue Flag, which are also diuretic. Echinacea is the now an immunomodulator. And again, talking about language, I think we made a mistake there when we first categorized it as an immunostimulant. And then orthodoxy goes, oh, it must be contraindicated in autoimmune conditions.
Yeah.
See what the trouble that these labels get you into, you know. Wild indigo with antiseptic properties, poke root, something of a cathartic as well, they say. Bear's foot as a lymphatic agent, and blue flag also as a cholagogue. And then the only tonic one they list is DOC, which of course contains anthraquinoglycosides, mm-hmm. but again, herbalists are used not to have to correct that action with carminatives. And then the only relaxing one in there is figwort.
Quite a robust list, I'd say.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think that's a good list there. Checking Dr. William Cook's physiomedical dispensatory from 1869 as well. You know, he will have other ones in there as well that are, you know, North American herbs. Mm-hmm. But he said that too often relaxing alteratives were used. So it seems Priest and Priest may have learned from that, because most of theirs are actually stimulating alteratives. Coming back to David Hoffman then, so definitely a West, you know, a UK trained herbalist. He says the alterative action is not understood. It appears unclear. The concept of blood cleansing is meaningless. They work as eliminative agents or by stimulating digestion function or as immunomodulators. So once again, we've got that physiomedical idea of they clear toxins or they somehow help nourishment. Here he's talking about digestive function, but nourishment of tissues, or that immunomodulator simply to, as it were, put echinacea into its new category. And Matthew Wood, in his Six Tissue States, puts alteratives as alongside bitters and laxatives. So you've got that as treatment for a tissue state of torpor, flabby, weak, undernourished tissues with accumulation of toxins. So we've still got that idea of clearing toxins.
An idea of excess, really. It's talking about sort of a build-up and accumulation of what fluids, wastes,
yeah.
visible signs of excess, really.
That's right. So that's torpor. Okay, so we've still got that same theme running through, haven't we? The question is just which ones to use and for how long and at what dose. But Bartram, go to Bartram's encyclopedia, an alterative action, and you know this one because we touched on it last time, an alterative action has been superseded by the term adaptogen, a substance that helps the body to adapt to a new strain or stress by stimulating the body's own defensive mechanism.
I mean, linguistics are funny, isn't it? The description sounds quite good, but calling it an adaptogen, of course, confuses it with a modern description of what we term adaptogens and the whole sort of adaptive response. But yeah, I was very surprised to read that and hear that.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's hard to get your head around that because I did check. There's a paper from 2018 on herbal supplements used in sports, you know, and so they are using a whole range of herbs, including the ginsengs and so forth, Tribulus terrestris, caffeine, ephedra, of course, that's banned, KN, and others. But the evidence isn't strong that these massively make a difference to sports performance, but there is evidence they make a small difference in some studies or a moderate difference in some studies. So they're definitely
meaning adaptogens,
being used.
Graham. You're meaning what we would call
adaptogens. I'm talking about adaptogens, yeah. So
not the misnamed alteratives as adaptogens.
No, we're talking about adaptogens. So, you know, so it's hard to imagine the alteratives. It's hard to agree with Bartram that the alteratives we've just listed from Priest and Priest can be used by sports, by athletes, you know, to increase their strength and resilience in performance. But what is interesting is, of course, that conventional science doesn't recognize the term adaptogen in the same way that it wouldn't recognize the term alterative. These are kind of meaningless. There's no meaning behind that, you know, whereas we know what a diuretic means. And of course, someone like Varro argued that actually herbal diuretics should be called aquaretics because, you know, they don't do the same as drug diuretics. So we're back to that sort of semantic play. But yeah, neither of us can quite agree with Bartram there.
No. Well, language is, you know, it's this whole basis on the history of herbalism, you know, modern medicine finding their own path and herbalists growing out of and potentially, you know, adopting some of that language as a need to be accepted, which is often the case in cultures, isn't it? To be accepted into the fold, you often adopt the language of the sort of dominant culture in a way. And I think that gets us into all sorts of problems when we call things even an anti-inflammatory or, you know, this whole area, we're using medical terms, which perhaps herbs don't work in that way.
Yeah, I'm coming to that. But I would say, you know, over the period that I've been in practice and since, so from 1990, you know, the BMA pamphlets that came out called us in the early 80s sort of like mumbo jumbo workers, you know, and then in the 90s, how to work, you know, with CAM practitioners for the benefit of patients. But actually in the last couple of decades, ranks have completely closed. In British medicine, for CAM practice, I think, although acupuncture's in there, and of course, the manipulative therapies, osteopathy, and chiropractic got statutory regulated. But to herbal and homeopathy, herbal medicine, homeopathy closed ranks, and I think COVID has now made the COVID pandemic has made it even worse, you know, where CAM practitioners are now linked in research papers I've seen with anti-vaxxers, you know.
But I understand, yeah, that is going on, and it is that's not appropriate at all. The level of professionalism and scientific, artistic application of health, healing, and medicine is superior, or, you know, it's a great level with that herbalists are trained to. So yeah, there's no need for this division of camps. I think there's a lot that each side can offer.
Yeah, I mean, you know, to be honest, it's because we sell medicines, and that gets in the way of pharmaceutical profits. I think that's what the difference is. But yeah, I totally agree with you. You've got a lot to offer, but that's why I want us to be clear about what we say our herbs do, and not to dwell on things because traditionally they were described as that. But, you know, here's my question. Does cleansing the blood, you know, to using, you know, make a person more resilient? My experience of practice is that, you know, where you have you know, I've had patients like this, where you have a patient who's had an acute condition, and then suddenly they're going downhill, they're not getting over it, they're getting fatigued, that, you know, you've got glands coming up and going down, sort of temperature and then disappearing again. That is exactly the kind of condition where actually some stimulating alteratives should be used in the mix, it seems to me. And I can think of one patient where that simply brought her back to the acute condition, which she then threw off, and she was healthy. You see, you know, we might say that chronic fatigue syndrome, long COVID, is a kind of chronic condition because they've never actually managed to bring up, fight the condition off, and it's still with them. Is that something you'd agree with?
It is. I think it's almost like there can be a veil, if you like, or a layer that can block the body absorbing the nutrition, the energy, vitality that is needed to throw off diseases. And I think that often you do need to, cleanse the ground before it can be nourished and flourish. And, you can use all sorts of metaphors of gardening or cleaning wallpaper off the wall and painting it with a primer and then putting the colour on. But you need to cleanse the system for it to be fully receptive. And I do think that is time-tested and proven in lots of ways. How strong you go in and for how long for, I think that is the nuance of practice. Yeah. And perhaps that's changed over time to be more gentle in this modern era. But I think it's fundamental. And just going in with tonics and adaptogens because people are tired or run down, it's strictly the wrong approach. I mean, it may be appropriate, but you shouldn't be your only route.
Yeah. That's right. That's too early to give tonics. You have to cleanse the system first, as you say. That's absolutely right. And that's clearly borne out in the longer tradition. If we go back much earlier than physiomedicalism or Thompsonian medicine, mm-hmm. And so when we do go back, what you know, there might be these herbs that we now call alteratives, but they run alongside what we now call stimulant laxatives, And these, of course, are, things like senna.
Rhubarb roots.
These are on the gentle end of laxative compared to some of the cathartics that were used, say, in Culpepper's day. And so... just to give you some examples then, Arthur Barker, students at the School of Herbal Medicine used to get the Arthur Barker Award. I got the Arthur Barker Award. And then years later, I got his book, The Herbal Pocket Prescriber, 1938.
Hmm.
Many prescriptions. I remember talking to Michael McIntyre about this. He agreed with my observation that many herbs contain syrup of senna. This was from the National Botanic Pharmacopoeia in the UK. That was produced by NIM, to be taken, however, in sub-laxative doses. So although senna was in a lot of Barker's prescriptions, that was in a sub-laxative dose. And so that immediately reminds me of Rudolf Weiss's reducing tea for obesity. He says, a strong laxative, a good diuretic, and an antidiscratic drug such as dandelion or parsley, plus a carminative for a few days or a week at most, then a long break. Now, that's an interesting therapeutic strategy, I think. Do you know of that in the East, that kind of quick burst of a laxative and an anti, a sort of an alterative, really, dandelion or a liver herb and a carminative and a diuretic? And then a gap, do you know of that particular treatment strategy?
It definitely would be part of either people would do it seasonally or as a routine part of beginning a treatment. Definitely, you might use something stronger at first, warn the client to be prepared. It's a week of treatment and that they need to be, near a home and easy access to bathrooms and things. And then go on to treat that way. But you'd probably carry on with some gentle depuratives. In Ayurveda medicine, often you're mixing tonics with cleansing herbs at the same time. So it's often that approach is used to, optimize digestion, ensure that there is cleansing going on and nourish. You might do them all at the same time.
Yeah, and I think Simon Mills has talked about that in one of his books as well, Out of the Earth, I think. There's a really great book in the history of medicine called The Woman Beneath the Skin. I can't see it on my shelf immediately, but it is a very well-known book. And what it does is describe the practice of a German doctor around the year 1800. It's sort of like maybe 1810 or whatever, because there was a massive change in an understanding of the body. So we're talking about anatomy and physiology. Leading to changes in therapy in that early 19th century period. So that because in The Woman Beneath the Skin, the doctor is talking about all these women that come in, they want emmenagogues and they want laxatives. And this relates to an older idea, which, you know, was around in Culpepper's day and right back, you know, to Greek medicine, where life is about things coming into the body and then moving out of the body. It's a flowing in and out of life. And you take things into the body and you've got to make sure that the waste from those is properly excreted, you know. So emmenagogues is a way of cleansing the womb, as it were. It's not, you know, fair enough, they were used to bring on abortion. But the more therapeutic idea about emmenagogues is that idea of things coming into the body and things coming out of the body. And so the same with you know, laxatives and so forth. But from the early 19th century, so, you know, and it's not long before in the 19th century we're into the Victorian period. And so that Victorian continence is the new thing, and we still have that today. You know, when you, where, you know, the doctor will go, well, you know, the bowel motions of a patient, you know, we don't inquire too much, as long as it's, you know, at least once a week or something.
Yeah.
You know, whereas your sort of your naturopath cleansers want that to be after every meal. You know, that's 21 times a week. There's a big difference there, but, you know, and so that reflects the difference. And so that's an interesting point. And then it's not long ago since we were all using these kind of herbs anyway. I interviewed Nalda Gosling about 20 years ago. And of course, her father was Charlie Abbott, who was one of the a well-known herbalist in the 30s and 40s. He was revered in his hometown of Lee in Lancashire. Mm. And she learnt the use of vomits from Charlie Abbott, you know, and she remembers him taking patients into a side room where there was a sink, and, you know, the teas would be, you know, some kind of carminative tea alternated with lobelia. Because, of course, lobelia became, you know, the herb to use for bringing on vomiting. And she described a case that she had herself of a guy with chronic catarrh. Mm. And so she instigated this vomiting treatment, and he brought up this whole bolus of phlegm. And it's that, you know, was the source of his chronic catarrh. If you don't get that out, the chronic catarrh will never be relieved.
And what you're saying maybe is that expectorants just wouldn't cut it if we're just using the expectorant on its own.
No.
You need something that would take it to another level.
Yeah, I mean, you know, in the sort of Culpepper terms, expectorants are hot and dry because they cut up the phlegm into smaller pieces that can be, you know, brought up by the ciliary transportation mechanism. But a big load, you can't, you know.
Do you think there's something, Graham, that I could just ask about this discussion of depuratives and ultratives that was tied up with the cultural view that the flesh is the seat of sin or problems, should we say, and that you always needed to cleanse the flesh, and that therefore some of these stronger treatments was, you know, particularly we talk about heroic treatments, sort of medicine's got a bad reputation for that, the 1300s or whatever. But do you see something cultural coming in there? Because there's obviously a very physiological need, but there's also seems like there's a cultural pressure as well to be cleansed.
Yeah, that's a really good point, Sebastian. I mean, I know people who they were part of a spiritual group, so it is sort of vaguely Christian, but there was this they regularly took liver cleansers, they, you know. Yeah. And then, you know, they're trying to identify all these stones that they're getting out of the gall, you know. And this is obsession, this is pathological. So I think there's a danger with this idea of sin, that people are gonna scourge the flesh, you know, because of course life, you know, the these transcendental religions are all about life in the hereafter, and this is a world of suffering. Whereas I'm sure you and I know that imagine, you know, there's no heaven, it's easy if you try. No hell below us, above us only sky. Imagine all the people living for today. You know, that's that's where I'm coming from.
It's an interesting area to explore, though, isn't it? Because it is a big thing in our culture, detoxing and cleansing, obviously dieting. It's just sort of an area to be conscious of as a practitioner, I think, that there is a need to cleanse, but there's not a need to only cleanse, just as there is a need to tonify and not only tonify. Is that sort of...
That's right. It can get out of hand. You're absolutely right, yeah. I mean...
We're calling for vomiting therapy and the great laxatives, Graham.
The old Hippocratic rule was that if the problem sat above the navel, you used vomits, and if it sat below the navel, you used cathartics or laxatives. I mean, I remember very early, I might even have still been a herbal student. I did a weekend fast. I dug up dock root, boiled it up and drank that. It was disgusting. And it didn't do much good, but I did do a 3-week bowel cleanse some years later. I don't know if you've ever done that. I was taking these capsules of Cascara Sagrada and chamomile, and I would increase the dose every day until, you know, it was just coming out. And then I think I pulled that back by one capsule. And then in the second week, I took apple pectin to sort of like, you know, supposedly cleanse the bowel. And then in the third week, you stopped the stimulant laxatives, but you moved on to a bitter, in this case, Berberis aquifolium. After 3 weeks, I felt great, I must say, you know, and there was a clear limit to that. And I only ever did it once. But, you know, there are some benefits to all of that. I don't know if you've ever done that.
Oh, Graham, I've done all sorts of cleanses and panchakarma and strong laxatives and all sorts of yogic treatments many, many times. And I find them very useful. I particularly like a seasonal thing. Like, for me, it's like a sort of rhythm and following the cycles of nature in a way. And you can see when the green shoots come up in the spring, we mentioned, you know, nettles and the parsley and cleavers. I like following that cycle. So not necessarily heroic levels, but I'll do something at home. But I've done things therapeutically with doctors in India. And I think it's an important part of rejuvenating your system is to give it a break for a while. And that this wisdom, under whatever language we call it, has really taught us lots to understand how to help ourselves and our fellow clients and family, etc. So I think it's just understanding the nuance of the herbs and their level of strength in relationship to the strength of the person is a crucial area.
Yeah, that's so. Hippocrates said medicines purge and age. And in fact, I discovered this only a couple of years ago that Avicenna actually purged himself to death. He was ill and he kept on taking these. So when you look at Culpepper's Key to Galen and Hippocrates' Method of Physic, there are very strict rules about using vomits particularly. And of course, the doctors of his day, you know, some of those cathartics were very dangerous if not used correctly, you know, as he points out in his translation of the Pharmacopoeia.
Graham, you know, the largest over-the-sale counter of herbal medicine is still senna and syrup of figs and things like that. They're still the biggest solutions people turn to. And you can see there's a need in society for that cleansing. We live in a sort of excessive time of consumption, but also perhaps not understanding how metabolism works as well as you might if you've been brought up to learn some of those things. And I think herbalism teaches you how our metabolism works so brilliantly and how you can be empowered as an individual to take control of some of those natural functions.
Yeah. And of course, you'll find senna in the BNF, the British National Formulary. Cool. But here's the point, Sebastian. You know, my impression is that Western herbalists are using laxatives less and less, but still retain alteratives. And for me, that doesn't make sense. Alteratives should be what comes after the more dynamic cleanse that can be achieved with laxatives. So to drop stimulant laxatives but to retain alteratives seems to me a retreat into, you know, I don't want to cause too much trouble here because I'm, you know, whereas in fact there'll be lots of indications, and as you say, it's a big seller here, and you know, it's one of the big sellers in Unani Tib medicine.
But
I know
it seems like the public want it, but herbalists aren't using it, from what we're saying. You know, it's very popular. If you go down to Boots, you can buy a Senna or whatever, your health food shop. So what's going on, do you think, amongst us herbalists and teaching the way we're taught? Is it a confidence thing? Is it
it's a confidence thing,
upsetting the client, or, you know,
it's a confidence thing, and it's not seeing it actually in practice. You know, in the training clinics or whatever, you know, and the same is going to be said about Schedule 20 herbs. I know that the CPP are now writing up their recent seminar on that, and I'll be interested to see what they say. But there's, you know, that's a different category, of course, because those are toxic in a different way. But there is this danger of retreat from anything that is really meaty, whereas that isn't the case in Eastern medicine.
No, certainly not. In Ayurveda, you're definitely taught how to purge and cause emesis and further cleanses, sweating therapy as well. We haven't really mentioned that. So you're definitely taught that. How much it's practiced over here, you know, I'm not so sure. That might be done more culturally. But there's definitely a place for them. And, you know, I laud you for raising the fact that we could be used. We haven't got so much choice, perhaps, with the diuretics so clearly. The stimulant laxatives are a bit more obvious, but I suppose they cause some cleansing of fluids naturally anyway. So you're
getting that diuretic that way. Yeah, that's right. And so there is, you know, just to remind people, that there's that older idea of life flowing in and out of the body, and that circulation has to be encouraged. So just moving on, actions of herbal medicine. So contextualizing the Cook writes, for instance, when a scrofulous case is connected with the torpor of the liver and great laxity of the general system, see that careful evaluation of the patient in sort of like tissue terms, it will not be sufficient to direct such relaxant promoters of sudoresis, that's sweating, and urination as Arctium and Selastris, which is false bittersweet. I don't know that. But such hepatics and tonics as sarsaparilla and gentiana become necessary. So there's Cook is showing that there's, you know, you have to differentiate between your alteratives. And alteratives is just one of the categories in priest and priest. There are stimulants, relaxants, astringents, alteratives, tonics, nervines, and the general category, not really containing sedatives, which of course is a challenge for certain orientations within physiomedicalism, diuretics, diaphoretics, demulcents, organ, and then organ remedies. Cook, in his physiomedical dispensatory, has stimulants, cathartics, diaphoretics, diuretics, alteratives, emetics, emmenagogues, and parturients, demulcents, and escharotics. The point there is that in both those lists, apart from the antispasmodic, there are no antis, you know, anti-diabetic, anti-inflammatory, you know. And so it's a real shame that we've slotted into a sort of a conventional medical idea that anti, that sounds like suppressive, when in fact we're supposed to be bringing things out, you know, and not suppressing.
So we're anti-movement. I'm with you. I don't think it gives a very clear descriptor of how a lot of plants are working in the system, actually. They're not normally anti.
No,
they're often
That's right. If we go back to Culpepper's time, here's Culpepper's list from, again, his Key to Galen and Hippocrates' Method of Physic. Emollient, hardening, loosening, making thick and thin, that's the humours in the blood, opening the mouths of vessels, that's heat to push things through, which could be a circulatory stimulant, or in other organs, for instance, the cutting effect of expectorants, attenuating, drawing and discussing, repelling, burning, that's the escharotics, cleansing, plasters, glutenative, suppurative, diuretic, emmenagogue, lactagogue, herbs to increase seed, herbs easing pain, herbs breeding flesh, scarifying, resisting poisoning, purging. So there's no anti there, you know. So, you know, if we're talking about language, we're increasingly using the wrong language in Western herbal medicine to describe what the herbs do. And I imagine that's because we lack a philosophical underpinning that gives us a clear set of treatment strategies. So I've mentioned Priest and Priest, of course, and they didn't have laxatives in there or emetics. But I've also got here Albert Priest's, study notes to accompany studies in physiomedicalism, papers 1 to 5. These are dated 1959 to 1963. So these are pretty early on, you know, in terms of our modern Western herbal medicine. And the laxatives are in there. So between, you know, the early 60s and 1982, we seem to have lost something, you know.
Is it we've needed to conform a bit more and to fit into a medical world? Is it this part of this complex in a way that because we're marginalized, you need to speak the language of the dominant culture, and so therefore you adopt that style to fit in?
Yeah, yes, it probably isn't before 1982. It's actually the modern movement towards statutory regulation, and so we have to be scientific and fit in there and cozying up to conventional medicine. And there was a little bit of cozying up. But then the quackbusters got in and got rid of all the courses in higher education. And now we're aligned with anti-vaxxers in their view. So that's really what's happened there. And as the Walker Report states, you know, we're not practicing scientifically, but traditionally. So let's practice traditionally. Let's forget this whole, you know, cozying up to science stuff. We do need to understand the body and our medicines, but it has to be more than pharmacology. It has to be more than anatomy and physiology as delivered by conventional medicine. It has to be more than that, you know.
I think it's about being rooted in the plants and in the patient, in the person, isn't it, to really connect them. And that traditional language is already developed for us, and that delivers in a clinical setting. I think we need to be able to have conversation and dialogue with other traditions, other practitioners, don't we? So it is important to understand, as you're saying, how the body works, etc., of course. But I think we should be proud of our heritage, and we should be confident in what the teachers of the past have guided us towards, basically. And I've loved our chat, Graham. I really support your view that we could be using more of these stronger class alterative, should we call them, and rejuvenate that whole alterative category as a leading light in herbal treatment that I really think it stands for.
Great, yeah.
Let's carry on the conversation. Thank you so much for your work, Graham. You offer so much to herbalists and healers around the world, your insight historically and obviously teaching at the university. So please carry on the great work. We love hearing from you.
Well, thanks for having me on this podcast, Sebastian. Great. Good to see you again.
You've been listening to The Herbcast, the podcast from Herbal Reality. We hope you enjoyed this episode. If so, perhaps you'd like to leave us a rating. That'd really help us to spread our message for herbal health. We hope you'll join us again for the next episode. And in the meantime, if you'd like a few more herbal insights from us, do have a look at herbalreality.com or learn more from us via Instagram, where we're at herbal.reality, and we're on Twitter and Facebook too. We'll be back with another episode of The Herbcast soon. Thanks for joining.